And I'd like to thank the KITP and the organizers of this wonderful workshop. I'm very glad to be here again. I actually gave a talk this March here at the beginning of this workshop. And how many of you were there? Can I start from question and answer session? Okay, well, I tried to make it different, but basically, I would like to spend my time on, let's say, current induced domain-wall motion and domain-wall resistance, and also current induced magnetization switching. Here, I would like to spend, two-thirds of my time. And before that, I would like to just describe you a brief review on the quest for higher transition temperature. What are the understanding and what are the current status of it? So, first, this is about the material. Well, you probably have seen this slide a number of times by now, but we can make gallium arsenide, indium arsenide, and many other compounds ferromagnetic by introducing magnetic ions plus holes. And the ferromagnetism we are seeing in these materials can be, surprisingly well described by this model, P.D. Zener model, where you just assume that you have a perfect gallium arsenide or indium arsenide, and you assume that you have magnetic spins separately, and combine the two by exchange coupling, and by having a non-zero magnetization, you will gain energy here, and you will there is energy penalty in this system. But at lowering temperature, this penalty reduces, and you get at some temperature, you get spontaneous magnetization, and that's our transition temperature. And this transition temperature happens to be able to reproduce many of the compounds, many of the experiments. For example, here we have a gallium arsenide case with manganese 5.3%. This is an experimental point. And if you use this equation with appropriate exchange constant and K dot P band structure to produce this density of state, you will get this curve, which is not far away from experimental data. And again, for indium manganese arsenide, you get experimental values are scattered, but basically this experimental values are reproduced reasonably well by the calculation. Okay, and also we have seen. Using this fact or this observation that carrier concentration changes transition temperature, we've been able to show that we can change magnetization by gating the entire structure to change the carrier concentration. So this P.D. Zener model can explain. For example, transition temperature of gallium manganese arsenide, indium manganese arsenide that I have just shown. Other examples are gallium manganese antimonide. I probably should add indium manganese antimonide, cadmium manganese telluride, and zinc manganese telluride as well. It also describes strain and temperature dependence of magnetic easy axis. Easy axis of magnetization is coming from the valence band structure, not from the magnetic ion itself, because here we are assuming, at least in this framework of this model, we are assuming a spherically symmetric manganese ion. It does explain also spin polarization of gallium manganese arsenide. We also know that it can give us a reasonable account of the anomalous Hall effect we're seeing, and a magnetic circuit dichroism, and also absence of anti-ferromagnetic semiconductors, because alpha is small. So without introducing effect of impurity band and disorder, we can explain actually many, many things that we see in experiments by this model. So this is a summary of what we have seen, what we've been able to explain using this model, comparison with experiment. Gallium arsenide, let's say here under the assumption of 5% manganese, 3.5 times 10 to 20th holes, we get 110 for experiment, and this model is 100, says it's around 130. So surprisingly and well reproduced. Again, gallium manganese antimonide, indium manganese arsenide, zinc manganese terride, cadmium manganese terride. So this was published back in year 2000 or a revised version in 2001. And it indicates that we can get even higher transition temperature for a wide band gap material. But it turns out that these trying to make these zinc oxide, gallium nitride, or wide band gap material ferromagnetic is a very difficult task to do. And we are now finding out that it's because of the chemical trend we are seeing in these materials. For example, this is calculation, first principle calculation done by Osaka University group. And this is gallium manganese antimonide, arsenide, phosphide, nitride. And as you go along, go from antimony to nitrogen, you get more and more D-like character at the valence band, at the Fermi edge, which means that here, for the PD Zener model to be a good approximation, you have to have actually a deep D level, with respect to your valence band. And this calculation also shows that the description of these two compounds are well done by PD Zener model. But when you go to gallium manganese nitride, it has more and more, it gets more closer to a double exchange. So the PD Zener description is not a good approximation. It's becoming worse if you go down in this direction. How bad it is not fully understood yet. At the same time, as it becomes more D-like, the extent of the interaction becomes short-ranged. This is gallium manganese nitride compared to, let's say, gallium manganese antimonide. So the interaction between magnetic ions becomes short-ranged, and we have to have more, let's say, manganese ions in the system in order to make it a uniformly. And even further, making things more difficult is that, this is again theory paper. Again, there is a chemical pair interaction in the system. So what they are finding out is that this spinodal decomposed phase is energetically more favorable than a random distribution of manganese in gallium manganese nitride, for example. And it's same thing is true for 20% and 5% calculations. It also turns out that this is zinc manganese terride, if I remember correctly, and this is gallium manganese nitride. It also turns out that if you grow it in a two-dimensional fashion, at least the calculation shows that you get this spinodal decomposed needle-like structure in the system. And these structures are actually seen if I remember correctly, aluminum manganese nitride films. And this is, we experimentalists have to be well prepared for having these structures, because, and this will give you a number of features that resembles uniform ferromagnetism. For example, because this can be ferromagnetic clusters, and because of these needle-shaped, needle shape, you can actually have a magnetic anisotropy, shape anisotropy, which resembles, if you naively interpret the data, you can see that, hey, we have a film, and we have a magnetic anisotropy coming from the ferromagnetic phase, but it may simply be from the shape of these inclusions. And also important is that these are all, in this case, wurtzite, or it has a lattice structure of the host material. So it's actually very difficult to detect these things by ordinary means, like simple X-ray diffraction, or just chemical analysis also averages things out. And if you go to core level magnetic circuit dichroism, they will also tell you where these magnetic ions sit, but it doesn't tell you how they are distributed. So it's becoming more, it's requiring more and more careful analysis on the experimental side to differentiate whether we have this random phase or this kind of spinodal decomposed phase. It is also true, and recently pointed out, that these concentrated phase can be anti-ferromagnetic, but this anti-ferromagnetism of these small structures, because they are small, the spins are not fully compensated, so you can still have some remaining spins available to be seen by, let's say, a magnetometry. So you can have they might be antiferromagnetic in its bulk form. It can have a ferromagnetic light signal when they are embedded in this form in the host material. So that's another thing we have to be careful about. Okay, so what about then gallium manganese arsenide?
Question?
Yes.
Can we expect independent transport if we have such a quasi-manganese system at home?
Yes. Actually, you can detect the presence of these, you can see from, depending on the material, you can see the presence of these magnetic phases in the transport. And in some cases you can see it, in some cases you cannot. For example, gallium arsenide, it's very difficult to see these inclusions, perhaps because, mainly because it has a Schottky barrier. Basically when you run your carriers through the structure, because you have a Schottky barrier here, you will only probe the region in between. But if you don't have these Schottky barriers, or if the resistivity of these parts are lower, actually you do probe the region, this concentrated region. So it depends again on the material that you're working on. At least that's my understanding.
Is there a typical length scale for the inhomogeneities?
I would like to say yes, but there are only a very limited number of observations, and using TEM plus chemically resolved TEM. I remember it's somewhere around. Well, I have to go back and I don't want to quote the some erroneous number. So.
In nanometers.
Yeah.
These calculations are done from energy constant for the type of calculations.
You're asking a theoretical question to experiment?
Well, it's essentially important. No, okay, that's not
okay.
Just to be fair, what I'm saying is, I haven't really discovered it.
Well, the problem of this calculation, as far as I understand, is to they're simply doing Monte Carlo steps,
right.
And it's not simulating exactly what's happening in crystal. So that has to be very careful.
That's the point, because I'm saying that the point I want to make is that in here you're going for a gas in a low energy state, and sure, but this is a very highly non-equilibrium growth system. So why? Or one expects to be more spinal than more random.
Well, that's certainly true. On the other hand, there is an experiment showing this kind of structure in aluminum manganese nitride. And so there is a good reason, well, at least this reproduces experiment. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're following the correct procedures. Actually, I don't know. You have to read the paper here. Okay, so gallium manganese arsenide. So, what about gallium manganese arsenide? And so, back in 2001, people have found this is University of Tokyo group led by Professor Ie and Katsumoto. They have shown that annealing. After post-growth annealing improves the quality of gallium manganese arsenide very much. So this is as grown, and if you anneal and grown at 210, well, the absolute value of this this number here or temperature is not of importance, because we all know that the machine to machine we have different we have different temperatures, but this is as grown, this is temperature versus resistivity, and this hump here is shows where your transition temperature is actually. So if you anneal it at let's say 220 degrees C, you can reduce the transition, resistivity, meaning that you're now increasing the carrier concentration and your transition temperature increases. And if you further increase your annealing temperature, it goes further down, and again you will increase the transition temperature. But if you overdo it at 310, the resistivity goes up and the transition temperature goes down again. So this method was very effective, and later people have shown that this annealing procedure, what this annealing is doing is to reduce this manganese interstitial. This manganese interstitial, this is not supposed to be here, but they should be at the gallium site. At least that's the site we want our manganese to be in. But if you grow it under this non-equilibrium growth condition, we get this manganese interstitials. And manganese interstitials are known to be a double donor, so killing acceptors, reducing our holes, and also antiferromagnetically coupled to manganese in gallium site. So these are antiferromagnetically coupled. So it reduces actually our localized spins, number of localized spins by this coupling, and it also reduces hole concentration. So this is very, very detrimental to for our gallium manganese arsenide in terms of increasing transition temperature. But this can be annealed out to some extent. And as you can see from this slide, this is manganese composition, and this is hole concentration, and this is transition temperature. And here, as you can see, this is as grown, and these red points show that samples annealed at 190 degrees C for several 10 hours. And as you can see, we can increase the number of carriers to almost no compensation. This green line shows that the whole concentration is equal to our manganese concentration in the system. So here, we probably can say that our manganese are all activated, and they provide holes. So we need localized pins and holes to stabilize ferromagnetism, and this is the highest. This is the ideal situation for this purpose. And as you can see, we can get transition temperature up to, in this particular case, 150 Kelvin. And doing very similar experiment, people have shown that we can go up to 170 or slightly above 170 Kelvin. But here, we don't know what's going on. By increasing the number of manganese in the system above, let's say, 7 or 8%, we always get reduced carrier concentration and reduced transition temperature. And this part is now under investigation, and we don't have any clear answer what's going on here, why we cannot anneal our manganese out. Or maybe there's something else going in to the system. For example, arsenic andesite is known to be a double donor. And if arsenic andesite is there, then based on the work with gallium arsenide with arsenic andesite, it's very difficult to anneal out arsenic andesite at this low temperature. You probably have to go to 400 degrees C. So this may be due to other andesites coming into the scene, or maybe there are some other factors influencing the way the manganese is incorporated. So this part is not understood. So this is the transition temperature of gallium manganese arsenide as a function of the published year. And as you can see, it steadily increases up to at least 173 Kelvin. And there is a report saying that by delta doped structure, modulation doped structure, the transition temperature can be as high as 250 Kelvin. But in essence, this transition temperature, keeping the carrier concentration the same, if we can increase the magnetic the concentration of magnetic ions, then we should be able to, at least in the framework of PD xenomorph, we expect to be able to go to higher transition temperature, because transition temperature scales with the number of manganese we have in the system. So if we can double the number of manganese we have in the system, then it should go up to 350, and if that's not enough, we have to go to higher concentration. Let's say if we can get 20%, then we should be able to go to close to 500 Kelvin, which is good enough for any application.
Question.
Yes.
What is known about the details of what happens during the annealing? You said the manganese, their interstitial, fuse out. I mean, do they go to the surface of the sample?
Yes.
And then what happens when you anneal longer? I mean, why does TC come back down? If you over anneal, I mean, what changes after all the manganese?
Okay. So the manganese interstitials diffuse out to the surface. And if you have gallium arsenide on the surface, actually you can prevent this diffusion process, and you will not be able to anneal gallium manganese arsenide even at this post-growth low temperature annealing. And if you overdo it, then you start having manganese arsenide clusters. And that reduces the number of manganese in the gallium sublattice, and that reduces transition temperature. So it's interesting. It's a very good question in the sense that why we can anneal these manganese interstitials out is something not fully understood, because after all, you're growing this gallium manganese arsenide at, let's say, 200 and some degrees C, and you get this manganese interstitials. But later on, at 190 degrees C or 200 degrees C, you can actually anneal them out. So there's something must be very different from the under growth condition and under annealing condition. But that is not. Well, I haven't done the experiment, but people have seen accumulation of manganese on the surface. I don't recall any study to quantitatively measure the surface manganese concentration and compare it before and after annealing, and how, so that the number matches, not, so that not numbers match. But so there aren't such careful studies, but that's our current understanding, or it's the current assumption, or current view of what's happening in the crystal.
Can you say something about sort of more fundamental limits, in the sense you sound very optimistic that get out all the defects and you can increase the concentration of manganese arbitrarily and keep driving DC up? You're already at pretty high concentrations of 10% and higher. Once they get close to one another, presumably the interaction changes.
Absolutely. So did I sound optimistic? I'm sorry. I'm quite neutral in the sense that what I wanted to stress is that we don't know what's going on here, and if we can understand what's going on here, we might be able to find a way to increase further the manganese concentration without reduction of carrier concentration, and then we might be able to get back to this track. That's what I wanted to say. But exactly, that's something we would love to know. What is the limiting factor, and what is causing this reduction of carrier concentration? And it might be fundamental. It might not be fundamental. I have to.
If you plot instead of X, which is the nominal manganese concentration, you plot the effective X, which would be the one of the uncoupled or unpaired substitution of manganese. What you find, at least for a different set of data, that those dots come to the left, and they're actually still following pretty much. The expected mean field. As many substitution dots as possible.
Okay. Well, what you're saying is that if...
I mean, here you're plotting this versus nominal X, which mm-hmm. is all the manganese you put at the beginning, but we were curious about, and we...
This is basically the nominal X, and if you plot it on the effective X, this can go somewhere here.
Yeah.
Well, that's fine. Again, we are limited to up to 7%.
Right.
So, in order to go to, let's say, 8%, 9%, we have to do something different.
You're saying that it's 9% manganese, really, if you have only substitutional manganese, it's a much lower limit at the moment.
Okay.
But if we can manage to do that.
But in reality, it's very difficult actually to get to this level, even in nominal concentration. So there might be some fundamental. We need to understand these fundamentals here. Okay, so that's the first part. It took me more than I expected, but current induced domain wall motion. So using this ferromagnetic semiconductor, we can learn more about, for example, in this case, how spin-polarized electron or carrier flow interacts with spatial variation of magnetization, like domain wall. Okay, so this is the length scale we're dealing with. Let's say somewhere around 20 nanometers. This is calculated value of the domain wall width, and nobody has yet observed, or experimentally at least verified this number. But this is stiffness is calculated by Thomas Dietl and Alan MacDonald's group, and this actually is a measurement. And that's thought to be constant. Okay, so what we did here, this is our ferromagnetic part, gallium manganese arsenide. And here we have a buffer layer to introduce tensile strain in gallium manganese arsenide. And the easy axis of gallium manganese arsenide is strain dependent. And if you introduce tensile strain, the easy axis becomes perpendicular to the plane. And this makes our measurement easier. So that's the reason why we are having easy axis perpendicular to the plane. And we use this step structure. This is our gallium manganese arsenide, originally a 30 nanometer here. And we etched 10 nanometer off. And because of the slight non-uniformity we have in the system, this reduces our transition temperature. This part 112 Kelvin, this part 115 Kelvin. And along with this transition temperature, it also changes our coercivity. And this coercivity is smaller here and greater here. So by magnetic field sweep, we can reverse the magnetization of this part while keeping the magnetization of this part unchanged. And that's the way we introduced domain wall, or positions our domain wall at this boundary of at this boundary or at this step position. Okay, so that's how we prepared our domain wall. And once it's prepared, we can move it back and forth, so we don't need any magnetic field sweep to do the experiment. So this is how we measured. First, we fixed our current pulse magnitude, in this case 8 times 10 to the 5 amps per square centimeter. And here's 1 microsecond. The original position is here. This is a differential image, so you only see whitish part, whitish part says the region where your domain wall passed through. So this is 1 micron, 1.5, 2 micron, 2.5. And if you plot it this position as a function of the pulse, you get this straight line from which you can determine the velocity of our domain wall. Okay, and if you in order to generate this curve, this is velocity as a function of current density under several different temperatures, and in order to generate this curve, we had to calibrate our sample temperature, because sample temperature is actually current density dependent. And it, very fortunately, in our case, it was not pulse width dependent. So actually, we do see increase in temperature, but our heat capacity of our system is small enough so that at even 1 microsecond, it's already in a steady state temperature. So the temperature of these 1 to 3.5 micron is about the same. But it's not 100 Kelvin anymore. But we can actually measure the actual temperature, because the wire resistance is temperature dependent. So using this as a thermometer, the resistance as a thermometer, we can actually trace back and see and calibrate this nominal temperature to the actual device temperature. So using this procedure, we have generated velocity as a function of current density. And it's surprising to us that this is actually the first time that the velocity is plotted as a function of current density in a systematic fashion. And that's because the current density required to see this effect is much, much lower than you have to have in metallic system. And here we're seeing our current induced domain wall motion somewhere around 2 × 10⁵ amps per square centimeter. So this says that it's almost linearly dependent on current in this high velocity region, and we do have some threshold below which the effect, the velocity is very much reduced. And as you might have already heard from Gen Tatara's talk earlier in this workshop, he proposed, Gen Tatara and Hiroshi Kono proposed a spin transfer mechanism for this domain wall motion, and they say that that the functional form of velocity and current should be like this. So it's a square root dependent, square root of j squared minus jc squared. And Tatara says that this jc is intrinsic. So it has to overcome transverse anisotropy of the system in order to have this domain wall motion. In order to have this domain wall motion. Yes?
Do you think that in your samples, the main boundary is straight across the sample?
No, actually not. Well, for they also, you know, you see this skewed. So the boundary changes with the shape of the boundary changes with the position. And also, if you go into details, it has some rugged structure. So it's not a straight line. Okay? And that's a very important observation, too. So, Mike Barnes and Michael, actually, I believe Barnes also gave a talk here. They say that there should be a linear dependence and there's no intrinsic threshold current. And Tatara and Kono also propose that there is a momentum transfer. So we have used these two functional forms, linear dependence as well as the square root type of dependence, to fit our curve, and we can determine this factor. We can determine this factor A from the slope, and we can also determine this critical current. Okay. So that's so we have two. This is the parameter that describes the slope, and this is the parameter that describes our critical current density, and we have two curves depending on which functional form we're using. And we can calculate actually these two numbers using, let's say, magnetization we can measure by squid, polarization we can assume that it's equal to the thermodynamic spin polarization, which can be calculated from the PD Zener model. And the Bloch wall is assumed, and the width of the Bloch wall, as I mentioned earlier, is calculated to be 17 nanometers. And the anisotropy, the relevant anisotropy here is to move this magnetization this way, which is described by basically m squared over 2 mu 0. And if you compare these, if you calculate these numbers and compare it with theory, then we get theory here and theory here. The first thing to note is that theory actually describes this factor A and JC reasonably well, especially this JC is almost identical to what we see in our experiment. So and also the slope here is well described by the Gen Tatara and Tatara Kono Seri. So it appears to me at this moment that we do have intrinsic threshold current density, which is described by Tatara and Kono Seri. And also this spin transfer part is roughly equal to what you expect from two theories. Basically, spins are supplied, and from the carriers to the local magnetic ions. It's interesting also to note that our experiment actually is much higher, well, at least two times higher than the theory. So when naively interpret this, we get more spins than actually the carriers can supply. And we basically are happy with this factor two difference. But if you go further into this, you know, we are only counting the spin part of the angular momentum, and we are dealing with holes. So if we include the angular part, the angular momentum carried by the holes, the total angular momentum, then we might be able to increase the theory part to here, which is might be more reasonable. And that part has not been considered by any theory yet. Yes.
So your theory JC is based on the expression just below the.
Yes.
So there's some errors associated with like the polarization and so on. I mean.
Absolutely, yes.
A little alpha linear. So your theory curve actually has error bars on it.
Yes, absolutely.
How big are those error bars compared to the separation between the.
Well, I would say polarization can be by factor of, let's say, two off. So it's some, you know, the error bar is somewhat
okay.
of this range.
But it could be the square root law or the linear law.
Yes, I mean, you know, this basically these two curves. Sort of gives you a feeling about the uncertainty involved in experiment, and this theory actually do have an error bar which is quite large. So these two are blurred and overlap. Yes, we have to assume, let's say, carrier concentration, for example. Because it's very difficult actually to measure the carrier concentration, and polarization is dependent on carrier concentration. So the carrier concentration was estimated from the transition temperature. Actually, the nominal manganese concentration plus transition temperature will give you an idea of carrier concentration. So that carrier concentration is used to calculate this polarization.
Right, but is the main conclusion I should take from this comparison between theory and experiment that things are in the right ballpark?
Yeah, that.
Not that you can say that the pinning follows a square root law and not a linear law. Like, I shouldn't conclude that, you're saying. Because the error bars on your theory curve there.
Okay.
Bigger than the differences between.
Well, you probably shouldn't take this. What I'm saying here is that. Our threshold is somewhere around here. So that's what this linear and the square root dependence says. I don't want this figure is not meant to say that because this blue curve is closer to the square root, this is square root dependence.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to understand.
Okay. So.
Parallel is some
exponent. Excuse me?
Suppose you try and fit data, use a parallel, J minus J C to power mu.
Okay.
And then optimize the exponent. What would you get?
Well, I would probably get a very linear, let's say, linear dependence because basically this is very, you know, more or less linear. Right.
Okay.
And that's what you get from this even square root dependence. If you go far away from your threshold current, basically this is linear, and that's what we get. And this linear part gives us this A, and it's not far away from each other. So basically these two curves give us a very similar number of JC and A, and they both can be explained by Tatara Kono-Seri. That's what I'm saying. Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that the theory is correct, but it gives us the right number.
I would like to formulate a little bit more drastic. I think that the agreement is more or less coincidental. I think these equations describe the experiments, but I would say they do not say anything about what theory is correct, because both theories, I think, are not really correct for these experiments. For example, that neglect all effects of spin flip scattering, which is now a big discussion, which also has been Tatara-san is working on that.
That's true.
This term beta, which completely changes the character of this critical current. And so far, the parabolic dispersion is changed into a linear plus.
That's true. Yeah.
On top of that, I guess it's all a zero temperature theory. Both theories are zero temperature. This one is very close to the critical temperature, and it's absolutely not clear whether the expressions that have been derived are valid in that regime. So I think it's very nice that you can sort of describe indeed the experimental data with these theories. I do not think that from a theoretical point of view we have learned a lot of it. It only means that if we do the job properly, the results will probably not so much different from what has been done. But at this point, I'm not satisfied personally by the state of the art of the theory just because they agree with the experiment.
Well, at least you can say that you have an experimental data to compare your theory with,
right.
With correct ingredients.
Yes.
So the temperature dependence here seems to encourage us to think that this is giving us some a reasonable account. But yes.
One more experimental question. Why are the temperatures so close to critical temperature? Is it just that when you put enough current in to have a motion that it just heats things up that much?
Yes. So we wanted to go to lower temperature, but we did not. Because at low temperature we need more current, and the current heats up the sample, so that's how we are limited. That's why we are limited in the temperature range.
So what is the critical temperature in experiment?
A critical temperature transition temperature is 110 around here. So this is our critical temperature. So T over TC, we're close to one.
I'm still wondering, is there some non-trivial spin structure around the wedge-shaped boundary? So the vortex fold or some...
We don't have any. Let's experimentally we haven't seen. We weren't able to see any structures near the domain wall.
So it is supposed to be some just.
Well, that's what we expect. I mean, you don't expect to have a vortex wall in this type of uniaxial anisotropy. Correct me if I'm saying something outrageous, but. So basically, experimentally, we haven't been able to observe the structure of the domain wall, or even measure the domain wall width. We cannot use MFM for two reasons. One is because it's low temperature MFM is not readily available, and the other thing is that our magnetization is very small, so you can easily modify by the field that you.
So can you shrink the width of the wires to ask the.
Well, we can do to some extent. We are measuring it by I forgot to tell you about, but magneto-optical Kerr effect, and the resolution of this magneto-optical Kerr effect microscopy is around 1 micron. So if you reduce your wire width to well below this 1 micron, you will not be able to see where your magnetization is, or where the, your domain wall is. Okay, the beta term, so I don't have to probably introduce beta term, this, if we want to explain this curve here, it might be due to just thermal broadening, but if you want to use beta term, a field-like term to interpret this slope here, it gives us somewhere around 0.1 beta, which is roughly equal to the number that we expect from other experiments. The spin flip lifetime has been measured to be 8 picosecond at 2 Kelvin in gallium manganese arsenide from the magnetic transport data. So it's within the.
It's the same at 100 Kelvin and at 2 Kelvin?
It's probably not. So it's probably more reduced than 8. And that gives us more or less. It's just a rough estimate of what we might expect from this. So now the sub-threshold regime. Here we have other activities going on. Now we are plotting effective velocity in a logarithmic fashion as a function of linear J, current density. And as you can see, we have this almost exponential dependence with respect to J. And again, Tatara and co-workers propose that this is thermally assisted domain wall motion under spin current. But in this coherent domain motion, you will have 1 over T dependence. But here, as you increase the temperature, actually the slope gets steeper. And this is clearly not what is predicted by the theory. So we took an experimentalist approach. We borrowed an expression from a work done some years ago, and we replaced this magnetic field by current. And actually, we found that by fitting these curves using this functional form, this mu first. It can be very close to minus 1/2, which, according to this paper, which determines the dimensionality of the domain wall that we are dealing with. So it's not one-dimensional, it's two-dimensional. So it's moving in this direction as well as in this direction as well. And we just use this A and B as a fitting parameter, and we can determine from each curve A and B. And we plotted it against temperature, and this, and we plotted in this form, Tc minus T, and actually this A is proportional to Tc minus T, and this B is proportional to Tc minus T squared. We don't know why this is so. But it's reasonable in the sense that we are now, as many of you pointed out, that our system is very close to transition temperature. So anything that is temperature dependent, we expect this Tc minus T type of dependence. So using this, we have generated for this curve. So basically what this says is that we can actually collapse these curves into if you add one more step, which we didn't because that basically collapses everything into one curve. But this figure seems to indicate that we have a current assisted domain wall creep, which can be scaled by the equations that I've shown you before. So this raises interesting question whether there is any field-like term here acting on the domain wall, because we just replaced this field, magnetic field, by current, and then we got this scaling here. So it might suggest that we are having a field-like term in this current assisted domain wall creep. So we wanted to go into somewhat more detail in this direction and see if we can say something about it. From here on, it's very preliminary, and we haven't gotten but I will show it to you anyway. This is, let's say, 1.3 times 10 to the 5 amps per square centimeter, so this is in the creep range. And the domain wall gets, this skewed triangular shape. And if you plot the domain wall position as a function of your current pulse, it moves faster at the very beginning, and then it gives us a velocity, which is constant in this region here. And this is
finding the position of the domain wall. I mean, it's sort of an extended.
Oh, we just count the number. Well, basically, we just add. Well, we measure the area and divide it by the width. So that's the reason why we say effective here. So it's not extremely clear from this slide here, but initially it moves fast, and then it assumes a constant velocity. Same thing for different temperatures, but it's not very clear from this figure. So what about the field? We can also drive our domain wall by field. And if you do the same experiment, now we don't see this triangular-shaped domain wall. And also we see sort of non-linear velocity. And at the end of our pulse, when our pulse gets longer, then basically the velocity becomes constant. But qualitatively, it's very different. And if you do if you repeat the same experiment, this goes like this. And again, it's not extremely clear from this slide, but the pulse width versus effective position of the domain wall are very different between the two, magnetic field driven and current driven. Experiments. You can argue that the domain wall, the front, the shape is very different. But if you go through the numbers, at least this is our tentative position, is that it's very difficult to, even if you consider the shape is doing something to the velocity. It's very difficult to make this type of curve to this type of curve. So it has to be very, very fast in the very beginning, and that's if we interpret it solely in terms of this type of effective field. So it seems to us at the moment that magnetic field and the current are doing different things in this creep regime.
This is a little bit off to your point, but I wonder if there's something like an inverse effect here. If you're driving the domain wall with a field, is there an induced voltage or a current in the circuit when the domain wall is moving?
Well, you certainly can expect some AD current type of inverse reaction, but here, because the structure is small, I don't think it's important. But I have to go through the numbers, and I haven't gone through the numbers.
Does that bond in my car?
This experiment is going on. I don't remember the name of the group, but we try to manipulate to move the domain wall by magnetic field and measure the transport.
That's
a Keele
So there might be such a thing.
Is it possible to broaden the main rule by current in the other direction?
Yes.
What happens to the profile?
Okay, yeah, that particular experiment we haven't done, but you can put it, you know, just make it back to its original position, you know, you can place it back to here, but I haven't looked at the shape change by inversing the current direction. That's a very, very interesting experiment to do.
Depends on the distribution of
both
hands across the sample.
This skewness here. This skewness can be expected in a sense that we have a different Hall voltage here and here. So Hall voltage here and here are different. So our current actually is producing and also the current itself is having a magnetic field. So these two reasons or effects can show up in this type of skewness here.
So even in a homogeneous sample, it will still be there?
Yes, I would think so. And actually, if you can reverse the initial configuration. You know, you can actually have it this way and this part that way. And if you reverse the initial condition, the skewed part goes the other way around, which explains, or which is at least consistent with our idea of where the skewness, where the skewness is coming from.
What are the width of these
wires? Oh, sorry, this is 5 micron here, 5 micron. 5 micrometers, so it's a quite a wide wire, if you can still call it a wire. Okay, so this is the new result, and how long can I go on? And 5 more minutes, okay.
Question. So some of plots which you show us, this velocity versus current, contain some features. Some
that's an artifact. I'm sorry, I forgot to tell you about this. This, right? A waviness here, and it's coming from our fitting procedure, and we did our best, but we couldn't remove it completely. It's not internal property. So well, we should have done a better job on this. Okay, so let me just skip everything and just
yes. Do you have an ethical intuition why this current-driven domino walls are behaving differently than driven by magnetic field? This is a question for theoretical.
Yes. Well, one is torque and the other is field. So they I would expect. I wouldn't be surprised if they behave differently, but in this creep regime, what sort of difference I should expect is something I would like you to tell me.
The field is a bulk effect, the torque is sort of localized.
Yes.
Way more, there would be one.
Okay, so. I would like to skip the resistance part, but the message here is that we measure the resistance, a domain wall resistance, and we compare it with Seri. The domain wall resistance has been measured in gallium-manganese arsenide by Caltech UC Santa Barbara team previously, which reported David Alstrom. Which reported to be negative. So the domain, if you have a domain wall in the system, then you have reduced resistance. We found that the resistance is positive. So in order to interpret the data somewhat consistently, we just plotted the resistivity versus domain wall resistance, and And so the material that the gallium manganese arsenide used in Caltech Santa Barbara experiment does have resistivity higher than ours, and it seems consistent, at least with a calculation done by Thomas Dietl and his co-workers, which is plotted by these red curves. So if you have more higher with disorder, you by introduction of domain wall, you will reduce the resistance. But with less disorder, you will increase the resistance.
Can you explain how they get the resistance to be negative?
Oh, it's because basically it's like magnetic field. So you have negative magnetic resistance in the system. And if you introduce the domain wall, you get reduced.
So you say it's this Anderson localization?
Yes.
Right.
Yes. That's how.
Which Tatara-san has expressed.
Yes, that's right. That's correct. So Tatara Fukuyama paper first showed.
Are the experiments at room temperature or low temperature?
These experiments? This is low temperature. This is at intermediate temperature. It's never been done.
Negative up there is also at intermediate temperature.
This is negative. This is positive, and this is at low temperature, and this is at. Actually, I forgot.
No, but also the one which is negative, the red one, right?
Oh, this is at low temperature. This is 5
oh,
Kelvin.
Okay, that's only the
same. These are calculations.
Well, it's below 5 Kelvin also.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's taken from 100 mK to about 50 Kelvin.
Okay.
In different crystal orientations and for different wire widths.
Okay. And a momentum transfer is proposed by Tatara and Kono as well. So we can actually, what they're saying is that because the domain wall has a resistance, it may contribute to the domain wall motion. And so we can input this our domain wall resistance to this momentum transfer force. And from their formulations, we get 250 meters per second for the domain wall resistance that we are getting now. So which doesn't explain our data. And from this, it seems that the momentum transfer force that they predicted is absent. Okay, so I would just like to entirely skip this part and summarize my talk. I've shown you that there is still room for more material science to be done in the quest of even higher transition temperature over room temperature. I've shown you that we can actually generate the domain wall velocity as a function of current density and temperature in gallium manganese arsenide. And the spin transfer coefficient A and JC can be explained within the factor 2 by the spin transfer mechanism proposed by Tatara and Kono. Also below JC, we have seen an empirical scaling law, which shows that current-induced domain wall creep is taking place, and there is a difference between J-driven and H-driven characteristics. Also, we measure the domain wall resistance, and it's consistent with existing theory, and momentum transfer is unlikely to be present. Here, you know, all the theories so far do not include spin orbit interaction. Also, we are dealing with whole system, so orbital angular momentum is not in the theory, which we would like to see. Also, the beta term is a somewhat mysterious term, and we would like to quantify whether it is there or not by experiment. We also would like to extend our measurement of domain wall resistance versus resistivity to see if which part we get negative domain wall resistance. So thank you very much for your attention. I think